line. Again, I'm Tom Rowe in the Acre studio, but we're heading to Dutchess County. Event hosted by Susan Hendrickson and produced by the John Cage Trust. Laura Kuhn will be reading from the selected letters of John Cage, just published from Wesleyan University Press, in just a moment on WGXC and Wave Farm Radio. All right, we're going live to Dutchess County now. Laura Kuhn reading from the new John Cage book.
This isn't really a book launch. It's just our annual John Cage evening that we've been doing for 3 years now with the graceful attention of Susan Hendrickson, who opens up her home to us and feeds us and gives us wine and beverages to drink and to convene and talk about whatever's going on around us in the Hudson Valley. We mostly do things around John Cage, but things that are associated. Like last year, we did an evening of percussion with Bobby Previtt, who couldn't have been more different than what Cage did or in his compositions or did personally. But this year just happened to coincide with the publication at long last of the selected letters of John Cage, which I like to tell people was decades in the making. This book was, the first letter in this book is dated 1930. The last letter in this book is dated 1992. I've been working on it for 5 years. So between Cage and I, what is that, 65 years in the making. It really was an incredible, both an incredible chore and an incredible joy to do. The letters of John Cage, as you can imagine, reflect John Cage. So they are not only letters about really a very singular composer of the 20th century, but a composer who Ken Silverman, the author of the Cage biography, put it best once. He once said, "Turn over any rock and there's John Cage," which he said made his biography writing so difficult because there was never an end to where you found John Cage. And that's really true in the letters, that as I was doing the letters, a single footnote could take me a week to figure out who in the world he was talking about, and it would end up being somebody from Fairchild Conductor, some scientist in the late 30s who went on to be blah blah blah. So it's just fantastic, the number, his tentacles, his reach into society as a whole, but also his own interests. So the letters are not just about music, of course. They're not just about a life. They're not just about dance, Merce Cunningham, but they're about mushrooms. They're about chess. They're about philosophy. They're about Eastern religion. They're about, chime in here, anybody. Anyone, you know, anyone in this room knows enough about John Cage to know that the context for his letters was phenomenally wide. He was a very far-reaching character. The bulk of the letters of this particular volume, and by the way, this is not exhaustive, so this is not all of the letters. This is the selected letters. I can tell you that this book came back to me quite heavy. It was cut back about 40% from what I submitted to the publishers. So I gave them 40% more than this to publish, and that was just a selection of the letters that I'd found in the world. The greatest collection of John Cage's letters, for those of you that don't know, are at Northwestern University. So Cage himself, perhaps presaging his own notoriety in the world, his own position in the world, started saving everything of his life from a very young age. So not only letters, but photographs, memorabilia. We have things at the John Cage Trust. We have backgammon games that are probably 70 years old now. We have Christmas ornaments. We have decks of cards. We have really almost anything you can imagine we have that Cage held on to from his life. He from a very early age started saving his letters, and in the 1960s gave them en masse to Northwestern University. At the same time that he did that, he gave everything relating to humanities to Wesleyan University, which was his publisher at that time, and then became his lifelong publisher, and everything relating to nature and mycology, including mushrooms, of course, but anything relating to nature, he gave to a wonderful librarian by the name of Rita Bottoms, at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He went on to write a beautiful little book called Riffs and Ecstasies, which Tony Kramer and I were just talking about today. So the collections of Cage were placed by him in certain institutions in the country. There are other institutions that have their own smaller collections. Stanford, for example, has things for when Cage did things at Stanford. Harvard, where he held the Charles Eliot Norton Chair. His Harvard lectures are at Stanford. So you'll find Cage, pockets of Cage, in a lot of different places in the world. But the correspondence collection is quite special, and it ended up at Northwestern. John Cage died in 1992. Until from the time he placed his letters at Northwestern to the time he died, I worked with him in the latter part of those years, but all of those years, throughout the late 60s, all the 70s, all the 80s, and into the 90s when he died, he would periodically package up whatever he had and send it off to the archives. They would pay the shipping and postage for these boxes of what became really, really priceless letters. He would send them off via FedEx ground shipment to save money. So the bulk of the letters, 70-ish percent, I'm guessing here, of the letters in this book came from Northwestern. So I spent a lot of time at Northwestern culling letters. But the other 30% come from all over the world. They come from people in the oddest places. So we put ads in newspapers around the world. We just queried people that we knew. There are some 6,000-7,000 people at present on the John Cage Folksonomy, and our website are just people that Cage knew. So anyone on that list would have been queried, do you have anything that we might want to include? A lot of things are rejected because they were duplicative of other things. What one wanted to do most of all with this book, which I'm going to describe in a second in terms of its layout, was to, first and foremost, of course, to let Cage's letters speak. So not get in the way of that, not be duplicative, not be heavy-handed, not be unnecessarily leaning toward one kind of a theme over another kind of theme, not to have preconceived notions about what this book shouldn't be. None of that was really at work. It was really just trying to be representative of Cage, how he wrote letters, who he wrote letters to, what his concerns were, and then in turn let the letters tell us something about that life. So a lot of things went by the wayside simply because they were duplicative. For example, we didn't put letters in the book that were just because they were famous people. And by the way, this book is only letters out, not letters back and forth. And for those of any of you who have done any publishing at all, you know that letters back and forth are a publishing nightmare because of the copyright issues on the letters themselves. Letters belong to the letter writers, not the recipients. So that doing Cage out, we were already covered because it came out of my editorial work with the John Cage Trust, with Westland, who is Cage's publisher. So it was a built-in easy process, at least that part of it. So the letters in this book are framed pretty much by decade. The first section of the letters, as I said, start in 1930. John Cage was 18 years old. And they start when he is leaving college after 1 year. He drops out of Pomona College and he goes off to Europe to find himself, as many young people do when they get out of high school. But he tried 1 year of college and then left. We take that first section, which is not huge, to 1950. I'm going to come back to this in a second. Actually, it's in 1949. Then his life until 1992 is basically broken up into decades. So you have the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, each one having more than a decade to give it to fill it out. There's also an appendix, of course, and a complete index to the letters. There are a little over 500 letters in the book. So with 50 pages of index materials and appendix materials, it's about 500 letters across 600 pages of book text. So I was telling my partner, Ralph, this morning when I was struggling with, I'm not a person who prepares very much when I do public things, that I really am much more interested in who's in the room, what the tone of the room is, how I'm feeling that day. So I don't give a great deal of thought about what I'm going to do. But I thought, Saturday will be good, you know, that I'll get up and I'll take a look at the book and I'll think about, you know, what it is that I want to do. And I have to tell you that this presentation gave me more trouble in my preparation than virtually anything else I've had to do for a couple of reasons. And one of them is that I don't know how to condense through a reading of these letters in 1 hour to you the volume that's in this book. I have no idea how to do that. I started first by putting little stick'em notes just randomly. I was like looking at this. Oh, I have to do that one. Oh, this one for sure. Oh, God, this one. And I ended up with about 80 stick'em notes. 80 times, you know. We'd be here all night. We'd be little three. Susan would be making us cocoa in the morning. So I really thought that won't do. Then I thought I'd do it by chance. That's perfect, right? I'll do it by chance. So I ran some chance on it, and I found myself doing this. God, that's not as good as this one. I'm gonna move this over here. You know, and oh, and it didn't pull up that letter. George has to hear this letter. You know, so that wouldn't do. And then I started to think about you all. I thought, I'll think about who's going to be in that room. Who are these invited guests? Because you're all invited guests. So who's here? You know, who wants to hear what? You know, and then I thought, oh, God, this room is full of people who know as much as I or well more than I about John Cage. There are people in this room who know just a little tiny bit, just the broad strokes of John Cage. And there are other people in this room who know enough to get themselves in trouble about John Cage. So that wouldn't do, because you all had different needs about what I would give you, what I would, you know, share with you from this book. So it was a real problem. So I just decided that what I was going to do, my contribution to this book is really in two aspects. We'll call it three. The first aspect is that I wrote you a preface. So I wrote about what this book is for me, what I mean to do with this book, what I'm doing with this book, who Cage was for me, what the John Cage Trust is, how it came about, and who I wanted to thank. Pretty standard. I then write you what I call chronologies. So these sections in front of each of those decades, remember in the beginning 20 years, but before these time frames, I write you a chronology of Cage's life based on the letters. So these are not biographies of Cage. This is really just using the letters to kind of shape what's coming for you. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of what those letters are going to get at in the next section. And then the third aspect, of course, which you'll have to just get the book and read it yourselves, is there are 500 letters I've written, 1,011 footnotes. So the footnotes took the greatest amount of time, quite frankly, to really kind of fill things out. Because when you write a book only going in one direction, there's an enormous amount of footnoting to be done. Because Cage is referencing perhaps a letter that came in to him, so he's answering it. And if it's not clear, it's left to the editor to say, ah, Cage is talking about this, or this request was made, or whatever it was, whatever it might be. So I thought that what I would do in this little reading, this little inadequate time together, was to do a couple of things. One would be to, I'm going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to read to you the first chronology. I'm going to read to you what I wrote, telling you about what the first 20 years tells you. And I do this for two reasons. For those of you who know everything about John Cage way more than me and are experts, you'll be a little surprised at the stuff that you'll find in these early letters. For example, there are 14 letters from John Cage to Merce Cunningham that have never been seen before. So they constitute the courtship of John Cage to Merce Cunningham. So there are little surprises in here, mostly having to do with John's romantic life. They were surprises to me. I truly didn't know. But also for those of you that are not super knowledgeable about John Cage, it might fill in some interesting places that are empty about his life for you. I forgot where else I was going. Oh, and the chronology will just give you an idea. It'll sort of set it up for you so that if you're not totally versed in John Cage and really don't know what to expect, the chronology will help you a little bit, pointing to letters and the significance of those letters. And then I thought, if we had time, perhaps off air, because we're on air for exactly 1 hour, probably now more like 52 minutes, we could, after this, we could talk a little bit. If people have questions or want to talk about things that I've read. So I'll read the chronology. Sorry, I'll read the chronology, which will just take 10 minutes or so. But then I'll read you letters from this first 20-year period. Remember, Cage starts this period when he's 18 years old. The first letter, I will read you the first letter because he's 18 years old and he's in Europe for the first time. And then the end of that period is 1949. So what is he then? He's 37 years old. So he's still a young man in this first section. I'm concerned that I may lose reading light. Is there anything like right?
Just
yeah, we could, I mean, I can start like this, but I just have a feeling.
Yeah, I've had this much
for
a while. I don't really
feel like
it. Is that better?
Yes.
Is that better?
Uh-huh. Definitely. Okay. Definitely. Is that okay for everybody else? Nobody got lit? Okay. So I begin. This is chronology number one, 1930 to 1949. In the summer of 1930, the adventuresome 17-year-old John Cage dropped out of his first year at Pomona College in California and began an 18-month trip abroad. Much of the time, he traveled with Harvard-educated Don Sample, 10 years his senior. From Algeria and elsewhere, he wrote home with great enthusiasm to his parents, his father, John Milton Cage Sr., a professional inventor, and his mother, Lucretia Harvey Cage, better known as Crete, a journalist with the Los Angeles Times. His letters are brimming with excitement and wonder at the people and places he encountered. Paris awakened him to modern music, and while in Spain, he did some composing. Cage's musical pursuit of a musical career began in earnest after his return to California late in 1931. Hoping to study with the world-renowned Austrian composer Arnold Schoenberg, who had settled in Los Angeles after fleeing Nazi Berlin, Cage began taking composition lessons with the pianist Richard Bulig, who was much praised for his Bach interpretations and who also played contemporary works. Bulig advised Cage to find a path to Schoenberg through one of his former students, Henry Cowell, with whom Cage then briefly studied. Cowell suggested that Cage get in touch with Adolf Weiss, the first American musician to have studied with Schoenberg. Weiss, then living in New York, agreed to take Cage on as a student. And in April 1934, Cage, with Don Sample, arrived in Manhattan. Cage took a lesson from Weiss every day and attended Cowell's weekly class in ethnomusicology at the New School for Social Research. In early 1935, his education well underway, Cage returned to California and began attending Schoenberg's classes both at the Master's Home and at USC and UCLA, studying musical analysis and probably also composition. For a while, he also took horn lessons from a local symphonist, Wendell Haas, but engrossed in his work with Schoenberg, soon gave up the instrument. Cage was broke more often than not, but also willing to do whatever work came his way. He took on various odd jobs, dishwasher, recreation director for children in schools and hospitals, and with much enjoyment, scientific researcher for his father. He also went door to door in his neighborhood, selling subscriptions, mostly to housewives, to a lecture series on modern music and art that he created ad hoc. Cage's youthful relationship with Sample was sexual, but in the midst of his musical studies, he found himself in love with two women and at the same time. Pauline Schindler, 41 years old to his 22, and separated from her well-known architect husband, Rudolf Schindler, and Zenya Andreevna Kashaverov, a far-from-Orthodox daughter of the archpriest of the Eastern Orthodox Russian-Greek Church of Alaska. Schindler's career as a writer, editor, and lecturer on architecture and the visual arts was advanced. She was considered an agent for modernism, as photographer Edward Weston once described her, the, quote, ideal go-between for the artist and the public, close quote. Kashaverov, a former art student at Reed College, who in time would leave her mark as a sculptor of abstract mobiles, a bookbinder, and a conservator, was reportedly small and feisty, possessing what Cage called a barb wit. Weston, Zenya's erstwhile lover, possessing what described her as most delightfully unmoral, almost pagan. Indeed, Weston's 1931 photographs of Zenya some involving full frontal nudity, captures something of her wanton spirit. Cage declared his meeting with Xenia love at first sight, and the two were married in Yuma, Arizona on June 7, 1935. Few of Cage's letters survive between 1936 and 1938. It is known, however, that a new stage in his career began in the fall of 1938 when he joined the faculty at the Adventurous Cornish School in Seattle. Within a rich academic environment that trained students in the interdependence of the arts, Cage gave courses in experimental music and modern dance composition and also served as an accompanist for modern dance classes. Having developed an intense interest in percussion music, regarding it as the perfect ground to explore the vast universe of sound, he collected and constructed percussion instruments and organized a percussion ensemble. On December 9, 1938, in Seattle, he produced what may be the first concert devoted entirely to percussion music in America. Soon after, he took his musicians to perform at schools around the Northwest, touring as the Cage Percussion Players, sometimes with Bonnie Bird and her Cornish School dancers. Cage's letters resume in 1939, and for 3 summers he taught in the dance department of Mills College in Oakland, California. He also entered into what would be enduring relationships with others in his chosen field. The first summer, 1939, he offered a class in percussion jointly with fellow student of Henry Cowell's, Lou Harrison. Brought together by Cowell, Harrison and Cage partnered to compose Double Music from 1941, working separately without consultation and then putting their parts together. It was also at Mills College that Cage first met the composer and music critic Virgil Thompson, with whom he entered into an equally long, if more troubled, relationship. Cage's music began to be noticed. His 1940 concert at Mills College with 17 percussionists yielded enthusiastic notices in the San Francisco Chronicle and Time magazine. His reach was also widening, and he gained an important champion in Peter Yates, a music critic and writer for the magazine Arts and Architecture. Yates, with his wife Frances, held concerts featuring avant-garde compositions on the roof of their Los Angeles home, aptly publicized as Evenings on the Roof. Yates explained and supported Cage's radically new ideas in many published articles, and the two forged a close, important friendship. Cage's various musical pursuits came together in his desire to establish a center for experimental music. He worked hard to gather funds and to persuade a variety of institutions to sponsor it, but his overtures were either turned down or simply ignored. Among those to whom he proposed the center was the emigre painter-photographer Laszlo Moholy Nagy. Formerly an influential teacher at the Bauhaus in Germany, Moholy Nagy had established a sort of American Bauhaus in Chicago, the School of Design. Accepting an invitation to teach there, the Cages moved to Chicago in the fall of 1941. In addition to delivering his course, Sound Experiments, at the School of Design, Cage taught and performed elsewhere in and around Chicago, a city not much to his liking. He and Xenia befriended Rue Shaw, president of the Distinguished Arts Club of Chicago, where Cage would give an explosive percussion concert in early 1942 involving tin cans, a siren, and shattered bottles that received national attention. Late in 1941, Cage was commissioned by Columbia Workshop of WBBM and Columbia Broadcasting System to compose a radio play with sound effects on a text by the poet Kenneth Patchen, also resident in Chicago. Poet and composer together created The City Wears a Slouch Hat, which was given its one and only live broadcast over the CBS network on May 31st, 1942, a Sunday afternoon. The public response from across the nation was a jumble of boos and hurrahs. Emboldened by the experience, Cage and Xenia moved to New York in the summer of 1942. They lodged for a few weeks at Peggy Guggenheim's Hale House, then in Montclair, New Jersey, with Cage's parents. They themselves had moved east. He gave his first New York concert at the Museum of Modern Art in association with the League of Composers, that was covered extensively in the press, including a pictorial spread in Life on March 15, 1943. And although Cage's letter, dated January 11, 1945, requesting exemption via a 3A classification from the draft, has not survived, we know that he avoided military service on the basis of Zenya's slightly exaggerated poor health, as was reported to the Selective Service System, Local Board Number 219, Los Angeles, California, by one Ernest W. Kolka, M.D. Gradually, Cage was turning away from composing percussion music to writing exclusively for the piano, both prepared and unprepared. Cage had long-standing interest in experimental instruments, as his many references to such composers and inventors as Luigi Russolo, Leon Theremin, and Edgar Varèse attest. His own prepared piano would bring him national attention. Inspired by Cowell's earlier unorthodox experiments, Cage had devised his new instrument while at the Cornish School, bringing forth unusual timbres from the piano by inserting various objects, rubber washers, screws, bolts, weather stripping, between its strings. Chief among his compositions for the instrument would be his Sonatas and Interludes from 1946-48. The pianist Mauro Ajemian, a devotee of contemporary music, would give the first partial performance of the work on April 16, 1946, at New York's Town Hall, which was enthusiastically reviewed in the New York Times, the Herald Tribune, and elsewhere. As Cage worked to complete the piece, which was ultimately dedicated to Ajemian, his friend Lou Harrison, who had also moved east, suffered a nervous breakdown. To help defray the cost of Harrison's treatment in a New York sanatorium, Cage sought and secured assistance from a composer whose music Harrison advocated passionately, Charles Ives. Cage's letters from the early 1940s tell us much about the onset of his relationship with Merce Cunningham. The two had met in 1938 at the Cornish School, where Cunningham, then 19 years old to Cage's 26, was enrolled as a theater student, but was taking a class in modern dance, which Cage sometimes served as an accompanist. The two reconnected while the Cages were in Chicago, but their friendship didn't blossom until both were resident in New York, where Cunningham had earlier moved to join the Martha Graham Dance Company. Cunningham began making dances to music by Cage, and ever more intrigued by each other's ideas and work, the two soon became lovers. Cage's letters reveal a stormy start to their relationship, he being by turns ecstatic and bereft. In either case, his work was clearly enlivened by the close proximity of a genuine and promising colleague. Unable to tolerate her husband's diversion, Zenya left Cage in 1944. Despite attempts to reconcile, they divorced finally in 1946. Artistically, Cage's union with Cunningham was an immediate success. Their first recital together in April 1944 included six prepared piano pieces by Cage with solo dances by Cunningham. The reviews were glowing. Among other acclaimed early collaborations was their May 1947 performance of The Seasons at Broadway's Ziegfeld Theater with scenery and costumes by Osamu Noguchi. Throughout these years, Cage undertook much else. He considered composing a dance score for Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells, an idea proposed in 1945 by the dancer-choreographer Ruth Page and her husband Thomas Hart Fisher. In the fall of 1946, Cage met in New York the visiting Indian musician Geeta Sarabhai. The two became good friends and met several times a week over 5 months, exchanging ideas about Indian music and philosophy and the teachings of Arnold Schoenberg that would resonate in Cage's life and work for decades. Cage also wrote and published articles about contemporary music, including his own, and in the winter of 1947 founded a short-lived art and literary magazine, Possibilities, with the artist Robert Motherwell. In the summer of 1948, Cage and Cunningham were in residence at Black Mountain College near Asheville, North Carolina. The director of the small experimental school was Joseph Albers, a German-born artist who had taught in the Bauhaus but fled Nazi Germany and joined the Black Mountain faculty. While Cage's letters provide little detail, it is known that during his two visits with Cunningham in 1948 and again in 1952, Cage played his complete sonatas and interludes for the first time in public and offered courses, including structure of music for dance. He also produced a festival devoted to the works of Erik Satie, which included an ongoing staging, an original staging, of Satie's Dada comedy, The Ruse of Medusa, starring R. Buckminster Fuller as the Baron Medusa, Elaine de Kooning as his daughter Frisette, and Cunningham as Jonas, a costly mechanical monkey. Cage was enamored with Satie and revealed his ever-widening knowledge about the French composer when writing about his works to both Yeats in 1948 and Cecil Smith in 1950, a writer for Musical America. Cage's correspondence becomes unusually rich after March 23, 1949, when he and Cunningham sailed for Europe. His many letters to friends and family record a lively social, intellectual, and artistic life abroad. Cage visited Giacometti and Brancusi, played for one of Olivier Messiaen's classes, and at least twice visited Alice B. Toklas. He delighted in knowing Maggie Nogueira, a generous Brazilian woman who provided dinner and theater invitations in Amsterdam, as well as the use of her chauffeured car. Nogueira was closely connected to another of Cage's confidants of the period, Peggy Glanville Hicks, an Australian composer and music critic who had acquired American citizenship and lived in New York. Many of Cage's friends visited him in Paris, including the composer Merton Brown and the painter Jack Heliker. Gita Sarabhai also arrived, now married and known as Gita Mayor, as did Mauro Ajimian, to perform Cage's sonatas and interludes with her mother in tow. Cage recounts a letter to his parents dated August 27, 1949, having to assist the Ajimians with all manner of logistics, which was not always appreciated. Amid seemingly constant socializing, including a visit to the home of one of the Baroness's Rothschild, Cage managed to conduct an exhaustive search for compositions by Satie, acquiring published scores and unpublished facsimiles for his own collection and that of Virgil Thompson. Ever stylish, he also managed to have new suits made while in Italy, which he told his parents were sorely needed. While Cage was forging friendships with cutting-edge composers throughout Europe, the center of his musical and social life in Paris was a former student of Messiaen's, 24-year-old Pierre Boulez. Cage considered Boulez's music the best he had heard in Europe, and the two became fast friends. Boulez introduced Cage around Paris and arranged for him to give numerous private concerts. Cage, in turn, took Boulez with Cunningham on a visit to Toklas and introduced him to Aaron Copland, a former student of the legendary French pedagogue Nadia Boulanger, who was then in Paris. Toward the end of his travels in late 1949, and despite what he called his wild, marvelous life abroad, Cage began longing to return to America. He had experienced and come to disdain Europe's commitment to the past, and his financial problems had become chronic. While in Paris, he learned that he had been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, but he postponed using it until he returned home. He also missed the loft he had only recently decorated and rented during his absence to someone who, he was told, mistreated it. Set in Lower Manhattan, the large new place had a view of the Statue of Liberty. That's the opening chronology from 1930 to 1949. For those of you that know a great deal about Cage, the chronologies, again, are not biography. They're telling you what the letters are telling us as biography. So I'd like now to just read a few of the letters from this section from Cage. And I want to start, the first letter is the very first letter in the collection when he was 18 years old. He was actually probably 17. He had left college, Pomona College, after less than a year, and off he went to traipse around Europe and elsewhere. So the letter, undated, but circa 1930. Dear Denver Cages and the outlying Cages, you found it slightly, being sent, by the way, from Algeria, Biskra, Algeria. You found it slightly queer to be writing to me in Paris, but you might have thought it still more unusual to be writing a letter to Biskra, Algeria. My letters from America now go through the most fascinating operations in post offices in three or four countries. They finally find me in some town in northern Africa with all sorts of different color stamps on them, and I have to pay a penny or so of added postage to be given the privilege of receiving them. Sometimes I just sit down and marvel, amazed, at the envelopes so exotically decorated. They often have stamps on them as beautiful and strange as the one that I shall put on this letter. I wish that you could be in my place and receive letters that had been forwarded from France to Italy and different islands in the Mediterranean and different countries in northern Africa. I have been traveling with a chap I found in Capri, Don Sample. He comes from Pittsburgh and from Harvard College and a number of other places. He writes poetry, which he refuses to have printed. And he likes to visit Europe and Africa in the same manner that I do. That is, we avoid with care the carefully swept tourist roads, and we crawl into the natural average places of the countries. I am interested especially in the people of the cities, all the people. Don is interested most in the country, the hills, the lakes, etc. He feels at home at present on a sand dune riding a camel. I am perfectly happy in a cafe watching the Arabs play dominoes and drink coffee. Or in a post office watching the Arabs send letters or receive money or find witnesses who will identify them if they don't know how to sign their own names. Vesuvius I saw from a distance. I found Etna far more beautiful, covered with clouds and snow, and not with funiculares sliding up and down it. The best part of Naples was its fish market, which was positively thrilling. The fish were kept brilliant and striking by having water dashed on them every now and then, as though they were clothes which were being dampened before being ironed. And there were all manner of fishes. There were even baby octopuses, which people could come and inspect and approve and buy. I didn't buy any fish. All of Naples is dirty and happy. People working sing. People sleeping in the sun in December. Across to Capri. It takes an hour and a half on the boat that goes twice a day. Over on Capri, there are flowers and bells and paths in the sunlight and walks down to the sand and little boats that you go paddling in. But if you go in these little sandalinos, you have to wear only short bathing pants because the sandalino is liable to turn over and land you completely in the Bay of Naples. Or at any rate, by the mere act of paddling, water will get into the boat. You can go for an hour or two, however, before you actually sink. It was very kind of you to send me the money and kinder of you to write the letters to me. I am always more than happy to hear from you. Please pardon my using the typewriter, but I have such trouble getting it through customs and such things that I feel the necessity to make use of it. I've wanted to send gifts from Europe at Christmas time, but the difficulty of taxes, etc., are apparently great. You will have to wait. My English, as you see, is getting horrid. I hope it remains slightly understandable. French is used more than English in Africa, and I'm getting into bad habits of language. Written note in the left-hand margin of this letter is, please write to Post Restante Seville, Spain, and say hold on the envelope. It's a recorded letter. That's the first recorded letter we have by John Cage. Cage returns to California, and he begins his music studies with Adolf Weiss to start. I'm going to skip Adolf Weiss for the moment, though. I'll come to a letter to him in a bit and read you the first letter of his first love affair with Pauline Schindler, his first love letter to Pauline Schindler. This is dated May 24th, 1935. Pauline, dearest, I love you always. It was in many ways puzzling to me that although you were in Los Angeles, she lived in Ojai, which is a very idyllic sort of valley in toward the north of California, that halfway between San Francisco and LA. It was in many ways puzzling to me that although you were in Los Angeles, we didn't see each other. I have not before now had the time literally to write, so that you may infer that you were right if you stayed away because of some feeling that I was too occupied. Bulig said, you said something of the sort. I had dinner with him the evening following your dinner, and it seemed strangely unnatural that we shouldn't have been together. Possibly I have not told you that Schoenberg teaches me counterpoint now, and I'm very happy because my work seems to please him. Today he turned to the two other pupils and said, you see, I don't even have to look at it, my exercises. I know they're right. He is a teacher of great kindness and understanding, and is a rich comfort that he gives. His recent suite in old style was played Saturday and is a marvel. There's nothing old about it, although it begins with an overture, prelude and fugue. The whole idea is basically a new concept of fugue. There are, for example, no two relationships of subject and answer identical. His feeling for the variation of idea did not allow of the opposite, nor of any another old idea, that of vagueness, so that the episodes, which are usually built of the latter, are here the development of the prelude. It is fascinating because the prelude is largo and is forever interrupting the fugue allegro. The work is convincing in every way and proves in a manner understandable to the most sluggish of ears the profundity of the prelude. And now, Xenia. All I know is that she will be here early in June, that there was a formal announcement, her sister's idea, in order that showers might follow, and that I am, according to mother, as unprepared as though I were living on the streets. Xenia knows this and says she will accept even starvation with me gracefully. I had a letter from Mr. Poland in which I was offered a position without pay, which unfortunately I could not accept. I saw the family doctor today, and he tells me spontaneously that he is amazed at my health, which he has never known to be better. He means mentally, no frustrations, etc. He says, if it continues, I will get even fatter. I ran into a lady who has a daughter in much the same condition as Mark. Mark was Pauline's son, who was ill, mysteriously. And she claims that although the injections are necessary, that they alone will not do the thing, that diet is of supreme importance. She has taken the whole matter very scientifically. Vitamins. Would you like to get in touch with her? Yeast. A vegetable juicer. Cage had, really throughout his life, one could say, without argument, three intellectual partners, and one could easily argue at least four or five. But the three primary intellectual relationships that he had, first with Peter Yates, who was a writer and a theorist, and with his wife, Frances Yates, the producer of the Evenings on the Roof concerts, great, great intellect and great interest in modern music. Second was Pierre Boulez, the French composer, which Cage exchanged many, many letters. There's a volume of letters just between Cage and Boulez that one can acquire, still in print. Hugely intellectual relationship, probably one of the most rich and important in the history of 20th century work. And then the third, without argue, would be John Cage and David Tudor, his collaborator of so many years, a pianist, who Cage worked out. David Tudor was his greatest interpreter. Some would say that, some can argue, could argue all night, but some might say about David Tudor that David Tudor made John Cage possible, because David Tudor was of such skill in the 1940s that he met his expertise with the instrument, met John Cage's expertise with ideas, and made it possible for Cage to write. So you have those three individuals. I'm not going to read you anybody but a little bit of Peter Yates, because Peter Yates was first. And I'm just going to read you a part of this letter, which is really 8 pages long. But I'm reading it for a reason, and that is just to give you an idea of Cage's, both his desire to fit, his desire to move forward, his desire to be accepted, to learn, and his cheekiness of going to the head of the company, of really just spouting his thoughts. So this is his first letter, known letter, to Peter Yates, dated December 14th, 1940. So Cage, what was he, 28. He's 28 years old. Peter Yates has written to him to say how interested he is in Cage's work, that he saw a little something in the newspaper, or he read something, not important. This is, I'm just going to read a little bit of this letter to you. This is Cage's first response. Dear Peter, I appreciate your interest in my work and the trouble you have taken to write the enclosed article. For many reasons, however, I am certain the publishing of this article would not serve either your or my best interests. People are accustomed to saying that anything printed about anything is good publicity. Such a point of view doesn't interest me. I am anxious that the article you publish be accurate as to facts and present some true and sensible critical evaluation of the work and percussion and its objectives. have not really delayed answering your note. I have instead written several letters to you, each of which attempted to point out the errors in your article. I have decided instead that it would be better for you to write a new article entirely, and that I could best help you by giving you a brief statement of facts, brief statement about facts and objectives. He goes on in this letter to give, as I said, an 8-page primer on the history of percussion music to Peter Yates. I don't really need to read you a whole lot more, but it's just interesting that Peter Yates would remain Cage's intellectual correspondent for decades. I mean, they would fight throughout their lives together. What else did I tag here? So the letters to Cunningham, the letters to Merce Cunningham are really interesting. So up until the discovery of these letters from Cage to Cunningham, all of which are dated between 1942 and 1946, we never had really any clear picture of how Cage and Cunningham really got together. We knew they were at Cornish together. I mean, we knew that much. We knew that Cage and his wife, Xenia, went to Chicago. We know that Cage... I'm sorry? We know that Cage was a correspondent with Merce in terms of programming in Chicago. We know that. But we didn't really know how they got together as a couple. Like, you know, all of a sudden they were doing concerts together in New York. And John was never asked for some reason. I never asked. I worked with Cage for the last 6 or so years of his life. I never asked him, how did you and Merce get together? I made some reference, I remember, to him once about, oh, well, you were at Cornish together, to which John looked at me and kind of dismissed it and said he was a student. I was a teacher. Yeah. As if that's not it. You're down the wrong path there. Merce was circumspect about such things, so Merce never answered a question directly about anything like that. So these letters were a real discovery in the sense that, well, we don't have Merce's letters back, and that's a real mystery, because letters were written back, but they're not in Cage's collection. So we're still on the path of where did those letters go. But Merce kept these letters from John Cage. So I'm just going to read you one or two, just to give you a little picture of Cage in 1942. Here's one, undated, postmarked, however, June 29, 1943. No location indicated, although Cage is in New York by now, so it has to be New York. Rain finally came and it's beautifully cool. Wonder how long it will last. It was marvelous because it started suddenly and then was alternately terrific and gentle. I think of you all the time and therefore have little to say that would not embarrass you. For instance, my first feeling about the rain was that it was like you. Yesterday, with no success, I looked for a studio for you, found one that was useless for $125. Otherwise, the day was spent packing instruments and studying the corporate structure of nonprofit organizations so that the National Institute for Biochemical Research would get underway legally. God knows why they didn't employ a lawyer. This morning rode elegant US bus to Academy, thought about Enigma and his little friend. Someday, maybe instead of writing, I'll send you a present. I hope you're having a beautiful time. I love you. Enigma and his little friend, by the way, was John's pet names for their penises. Merce was Enigma and his little friend was John. So it was alluding to their sex life. This is a very beautiful one. This is undated 1944. This note that Cage wrote to Cunningham was contained in a very small envelope without postmark, is incredibly fragile and had been cut up into little tiny pieces. Some of those little tiny pieces had been folded over, and some of those over time had broken in two just by being brittle. So Cage had made a kind of puzzle out of this letter to Cunningham, which he had to reconstruct. The fragments comprising everything extant, I pieced them together and they made the following letter. I am in a world you make, and the leaf is suspended by a pin near the little wooden saint. These things mean very much to me, but I think it is not my credit that they do. I'm beginning to think that the reason I give so much is that I am so poor in spirit, hoping through leaning on every little gesture, thought, word, and mood of others to get my empty spaces filled. So my giving is really demanding. Where shall I go? What shall I do? Read a book? How to benefit by what can be said by oneself. Not being spontaneous and relaxed about natural things, I get ideas about people connected with art, fashion little pedestals, love them and bring the public in, a rather disgusting scene. I love you always. Xenia went alone. Beauty. I am in a muddled state. Calliope calls. Soul searching. I did it once before, about 12 years ago. I'm not very good at it. Lewis and Satie at breakfast. What did that mean? Here's a letter, 1948. This is a letter to Annie and Joseph Albers at Black Mountain College after Merce and John had visited it in the spring with the idea of coming to visit as a formal kind of setting. Dear Annie and Albers, you were so friendly and Black Mountain was so good to be at, and the last minute gestures and gifts brought us to a kind of ecstasy. The heads among the eggs were discovered near the summit of the Smokies, where the mist made everything gently awe-inspiring. You were as generous as they. We visited a Trappist monastery at Gethsemane in Kentucky. There's also one nearer you in Georgia. And we heard the monks singing Gregorian chants. We may stay there a few days on the way back. Every experience in going through the country and stopping with friends, or as with you, making new friends is revelatory. Of course, there is also ugliness and meanness, too. A disgusting dinner and waitress in Indiana. But for the most part, this trip seems tending always toward what is beautiful and meaningful. And I can only say that we feel we were profoundly lucky to spend some days with you. Merce is doing his technique now in the middle of Gretchen and Alex Carazzo's kitchen. Last night, we read out loud some of your pamphlets. Annie and all of us were moved by the clarity and truth of your thoughts. Being in New York without leaving it for so long had made me believe that only within each one of us singly can what we require come about. But now at Black Mountain, and again with the Trappists, I see that people can work still together. We have only to imitate nature in her manner of operation. We love the gifts you gave us, but especially love being with you. Tomorrow morning we go on to Wisconsin. And Merce Cunningham adds a little bit to the end of this letter. He writes, I did my exercising on the Carazzo kitchen floor, but kept thinking about the Black Mountain dining hall. I wonder why. The Trappists were interesting, but Black Mountain was better because we were able not just to observe, but to share, if even a little intangibly. Do we have time for one more, Max? How are we doing?
Five.
Okay, let me read one more letter. This is a letter after Merce and John have traveled to Europe. They've been there for just a little while. Anyway, this is a letter home from Paris. Dearest Mother and Dad, I have not quite recovered from the surprise of getting the Guggenheim, but I begin to. I sent you the telegram and then finally came to my wits and wrote a letter to Mr. Moe, the Secretary General, asking him to postpone the period of my tenure until my return to New York. I hope he agrees to do that. I am also sending him this afternoon a doctor's certificate as to my health, and I corrected the biographical statement. If there is more for me to do, either you or he will let me know. I cannot believe that it happened and that I am not dreaming. How marvelous to be relieved of the financial problem. Sunday we leave for Palermo, and until then we have been loaned an apartment in a chic hotel near the Champs-Élysées by a friend, Muriel Herrera Fink, whom I don't think you met. She is charming and has gone to Mount Saint-Michel for Easter and thought it just as well that we stay in her apartment. She and her husband have taken very good care of us, taking us to dinner, lunches, etc. We had a very good and cheap room on the Ile de Saint-Louis, which is my favorite part of Paris, right behind Notre Dame, about 75 cents a day for two. But here we are with the bad typewriter, a real bathroom, elegance et al. Muriel is also trying to swing a concert in the home of the Comtesse de Polignac, which is the top of musical life in Paris, if not in Europe. I haven't done anything about music in Paris yet because I was so surprised about the Guggenheim, which happened the first day here. In Brussels, I met many composers and had a marvelous time. There may be a concert in October at the Palais des Beaux-Arts here. I'm going to have a suit made in Italy because my brown one and my blue one wore out completely, and all I have is the linen one and Dad's Christmas one. Paris is out of this world beautiful, and the weather superb. Last night to the Jean-Louis Borel Theater, and again tonight to see Hamlet. It is quite different from before, not in itself Paris, but in me. I love it. Merce works every day in a studio near the Place Clichy and is trying to arrange a dance program for May there. The city is so beautiful and it is so easy to be alive here, almost too easy. You have to protect yourself, I am sure, by working. But right now in transit, cannot work. It is difficult to imagine how America got to be so un-European. There is so much general understanding here about how things should be to be beautiful and to make life a joy. Forgive this letter and its incoherence and lack of news. I simply don't know yet which way to turn.
I think maybe we'll stop there. Yeah. Is that all right? Yeah, okay.
So we'll stop there and maybe we could talk about some of these letters and we can talk about what else is in this book or whatever you want to do.
Can you applaud you?
Yes. Yes. So was there anything surprising or anything? I don't know. No?
You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acre.
You read it on Amazon. The first chronology? The letters?
What surprised you, Laura? What
surprised you? Well, the letters to Merce, for sure.
Why?
Because they're. I would have to probably read them all to you for you to get the full impact of them. But I never knew. Merce clearly had the upper hand. He was bereft at Merce not writing enough or not being responsive, that John, whenever Merce wasn't around, Merce. So that surprised me a bit because my experience of Cage, I only knew Cage in his later life. He was tough. He was a strong person. So I think that surprised me a lot. It surprised me, and probably you can't get enough of a sense of the letters from so little being read of them, how much time Cage spent, he was very ingratiating of himself upon his teachers. So that was a surprise to me. That he was, there are many, many letters to Adolf Weiss, to Richard Bulig, not to Schoenberg. By then, Schoenberg was a little aloof on the one hand, but also Cage was older by then. But there are a lot of letters telling Adolf Weiss how much Weiss means to him, and that Cage can't imagine his life without him, and so he's very ingratiating of himself. He really is so earnestly desirous of getting somewhere as a composer, of finding his way and finding his place. I think those are in this early section. I think those are the things that surprised me.
So did he make copies of this
Later, that was certainly the case. So for most people who corresponded with Cage after the late 60s, he used a form of correspondence called the notogram, which was recommended him by Dick Higgins. It was a remedy, John called it a remedy, to his having to write so many letters. They were a tripart communication vehicle, where on one side was your message, you would write that, and then on the other side, there was space for you to write back, and there was carbon copy between them, so you could tear one off for your file, you would send two to the recipient, they would write a response, and then tear off the middle one and keep that. So you both had a copy of all of the exchange. So he kept those copies. All of the early letters, none of these did Cage keep. So his parents' letters, those are all in scrapbooks that his parents kept. So his parents gathered together those letters. The letters to Adolf Weiss are in archives in California. The letters to, who else do we have? Peter Yates. Those are also at the UCSC. I think Peter Yates is at UCSC. We were talking about the archives at UCSC today. Peter Yates are there. So all the early letters up until about 1950 are in archives around the world.
So Laura, is there a moment people who are involved in the art world, but is there a moment where you get the sense that, okay, this is a moment in history and I recognize that I'm a part of
Cage?
The cultural life of the world, and so I want to preserve? I mean, early on, you're 18. I don't think you knew that he was John Cage, you know, now. So when do you get the sense that, like, he understood that, like, okay, this is a part of the cultural life of the world, and maybe I should pay attention to this?
I think it was early. I think it was really early. I mean, the mere fact that, well, his parents kept a scrapbook. He saved scrapbooks. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So he, from a pretty early age, the reason I just opened up that one little letter to Peter Yates and said he's 28 years old and now he's going to, finally somebody said, I'm interested in what you think. Here's an article I wrote. I'd like to discuss this. And Cage writes him an 8-page letter back. Let me rewrite this for you. Let me teach you the history. You know, I say I do a foreword to the book, obviously. And in the foreword, I say that one of the things that for me became very clear in the book as a whole, that Cage started life as John Cage and ended life as John Cage. That he doesn't, there's not a change. He doesn't, you even see, Joan, you've written a lot about Cage. You even see some of the language of those early letters is very much Cage's language from 50 years on. So I think he always knew. I think he always knew, but he was looking for agreement. He was looking for agreement early on. He wanted Weiss to pay attention. He wanted Schoenberg to... He likes that Schoenberg, you know, said, you know, this person, I don't have to even correct him. Look how good he is, you know. He liked that. And by the time he writes with authority to Yates because it's on the subject of percussion, but he's writing with great authority back and forth with Pierre Boulez starting in 50, 51. So by the time he's 38, 39 years old, he's feeling good. He's feeling like he has a contribution to make.
I'm a player.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's pretty young. You know, it wasn't... Yeah. I don't think... Well, I don't know. But I think that answers... No? Yeah. Anything else? That's a good question. Joan, do you think that Cage and Walter Benjamin ever crossed paths? That seems like a question that you might know. There's no letters in here between them. No?
I don't think so, but that doesn't mean...
Exactly. I don't know. There's no correspondence between them that I know of. Yeah. And he's not... I'm going to look in the index to see if he's referenced anywhere. You wouldn't be the first person who, like, made a piece about an imaginary conversation. I'm serious. You know, there have been people who have done imaginary conversations between Cage and people.
And
no, of course not. I'm saying you be my guest. You could do it.
I have a similar question. You referenced the stay at the Trappist Monastery at Fitzsimmons, Kentucky, which is the monastery that Thomas Merton was at.
Uh-huh.
Was there a relationship between Thomas Merton and John Cage? It's just a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Was Merton there at that point?
Probably not.
I'm not sure if he was there already.
I think he was there.
Merton, I think that Cage talks about Merton, but not that early.
That's pretty early. Huh?
No, not even a reference. It would be in here. I would have caught it.
But it is the same place. But that was early. I mean, that was, we're talking about 1948.
I think Burton had gotten there in the 50s. I think the 50s.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the rare, that letters, by the way, is one of, I think there are only three in the whole collection where Merce Cunningham adds a tag or adds something to it. There's another letter. It's actually very sweet. It's also a Black Mountain letter, interestingly, to... It's in 1952, as I recall, because it's Charles, he writes, John Cage is writing to Charles Olson at Black Mountain. And 54. It's the first year that John Cage has not been invited back to Black Mountain because, or it must be 53. Hang on, I'm going to find it. He doesn't get invited back. It's circa 1954. He doesn't get invited back because the previous year he was writing Williams Mix, this piece for spliced tape, magnetic tape, and it's so complicated and so time-consuming to do the splicing that he takes it to Black Mountain while he's an instructor there. He takes it to Black Mountain and he says, my students will help me do this. And so he takes all this tape and the students balked and said, we're not doing that. And the next year, Cage wasn't invited back. Anyway, that's one of the letters. I'm just going to read part of it to you, but it's not all that interesting. But it's got a portion of it, half of it's written by Merce as well. Anyway, guess how many? I don't know. So probably. I guess my answer is probably. Can we drink now?
What do you think he would think of this book being published by Cage? If he was alive?
Oh, he'd love it. Yeah. Are you kidding? Susan, going back to what you were saying, kind of to answer both of you kind of at the same time, it's not that Cage is sweet and honey through this whole book, but you get a sense that he's careful with the way that he writes to people. You know, he's rarely vicious. He's never vicious. He's rarely even cranky. You know what I mean? That he always finds a way of being delicate, even when he's unhappy, with someone.
Even early?
Early on, he's never unhappy with other people. He doesn't express it in letters. In the letters. Now, I shouldn't say that, you know, with the... There could be letters, I don't know, where they've been burned. You know, they said burn after reading or something. But there's really nothing in here where he's scandalous, ever. Okay. Were you...
No, but just in the way that the letters are so personal, I mean, you reveal so much, it seems so unlike him in a way to reveal that much. So if he thought they were going to be published, would he be comfortable with that level of personal disclosure?
I'm going to share a little story with you about Merce. So John and I didn't have that kind of relationship where I got that close to him. He was just, I worked for him. But Merce and I were friends for like almost 20 years. And in the course of my friendship with Merce, they're not his letters though, but I'm going to tell you anyway, and you can see where my mind was going. That it came to light that John Cage had clearly had spent a few years in the early 50s clearly in love with David Tudor. Okay, and there are letters. If you look at the Cage Tudor letters edited by Martin Idman, that's another wonderful volume that you can buy. It's just letters between those two people. But before that was published, that was many years later, it came to light that there were letters extant from John Cage to David Tudor that clearly were expressive of love, deep. And those letters were all dated in years that John and Merce were in a monogamous relationship. And someone found these letters in the Getty archives and brought them to me at the John Cage Trust after Cage's death and said, oh, look, this is really great and we have to publish these. To which I said, could we just get this cleared by Merce?
you know, because he's still alive and this, you know, could affect him. And so, I mean, it's probably nothing, but, and the person said, absolutely, absolutely go. So I took the letters to Merce, and we were having dinner one night, and I just very carefully kind of said, you know, they were found, and, you know, they're kind of intimate, and this person would like to publish them, and, you know, do you want to talk about that? Would that be okay? And he said, we were eating and having wine, and he said, oh, just put them on the desk. I'll look at them later. And I said, okay. So I put them on the desk, and we didn't say another word about it. And then I saw him, I don't know, a couple days later, I was over there for dinner, because we had dinner a lot, and I said, did you have a chance to look at John's letters to David Tudor? And he said, oh, I meant to give them to you. And he got up, and he carried them in back to the kitchen, handed them to me, and I said, did you know about this? And he said, no. And I said, was that hurtful to you in any way? And he said, oh, Laura, it was a long time ago. You know, so I think that both of them, that's the end of my story in a way, that he had no problem with them being published, that it was just a long time ago. It was part of the story, the history, or the story. He didn't know. He didn't know. Yeah. But David Tudor wasn't in love with John Cage. I mean, that's pretty apparent, too, that, you know, John was like this, and David was putting up walls in every direction, his biggest wall being that he married M.C. Richards. You know, that was a really good wall. Yeah, it worked. It worked. Oh, that's apparent in here. It all comes out. You know, there's a wonderful letter where he writes to David Tudor after David's with MC, and he writes to, dear David and MC, I understand you now live in the night in the world of the happy nights. I can't be more happy for the two of you. You know, and so, yeah. Now, there's no proof that David married MC to resist Cage's advances, but it makes sense. I mean, it makes, you know, kind of makes sense, that world. Really? Anyway, it's all in here. ten letters.
Only ten?
Mm.
No,
yeah, no, there's only there are 12 letters between 1942 and 1946, and then there's one letter in the 70s. Mm-hmm. There are no letters, or virtually no, I shouldn't say that so quickly. There's two letters to Jasper Johns, one letter to Bob Rauschenberg, no letters to Richard Castellanets, no letters to John Retallack. The only reason there are two letters to me is because I lived in Los Angeles for those few years. That's the only reason. There's no letters to Marguerite Roeder.
Well, that's because we were all talking.
Exactly.
Regularly, yep. And close to. Yep. He loved talking about it.
Exactly. But he also, you know, he talked to you when you were there. You know, if these people were around him. Merce was in Colorado for a lot of these letters. He was living in Colorado. And in Colorado? Colorado Springs. Well, he was there. I mean, he didn't live there. He was there on tour. So he was there for a residency. Then he was at Bennington.
Sure.
So he was not in the city. And there are a couple of letters where John's trying to find him an apartment.
It's always sad, like, so that it's a good.
Who?
Merce, John.
Well, they both were. They both, yeah. Yeah, so there, I mean, so he didn't write letters to people who were in the neighborhood or who he lived with or who were close to him, unless they were far away, you know. I mean, he writes to, trying to think of other recipients with some regularity. Just people who were not physically close to him. He wrote a lot from tour because he had time when he was on tour, so that might be one, but... Yeah, I don't really know how to answer your question, but there are only about 12 letters to Merce Cunningham. And I want to know where the letters are from Merce Cunningham to Cage. It's really an interesting question. When I brought that up to a lot of people, people say, well, he must not have written any. Maybe Merce didn't write letters. But John's letters, a handful of them in here, begin by saying, a letter from you today, thank God, I'm so happy, you know. Yeah. And so you know that those, but John would not have burned them. He just. That one gets, I don't know that I would word it like that. He definitely, there is a dance going on in these few letters, these 12 letters over a couple of years. There is a dance going on where, no pun intended, I really didn't mean it. Yeah, the dance being that Merce, you know, was never quite graspable, that John couldn't quite get his hands on him, you know. And one could argue that that continued to their respective deaths. Yeah, Kyle.
Sorry, you read every now and then from people who knew Cage in the 30s and 40s, they went through kind of a personality change in the early 50s. And even Peter Yates says at some point that he was kind of argumentative and truculent and liked to shock people, and then later he came up this mystic calm. His friends were amazing, constantly talking about Zen all the time. It sounds like you're saying that's not completely borne out by the letters.
It's not borne out by the letters at all. However, I don't remember what film it is, but there's footage in it in London. I've seen footage from a number of films with old footage in it, not from the 30s and 40s for sure, but 50s and 60s, early 60s, say, where I remember him swinging on a swing in this footage, and he's saying, what, are people stupid? You know what I mean? He's really pissed, and he's talking to somebody, an interviewer is asking him the same questions that he's been asked 5,000 times, and he's clearly got an edge to his voice and the expression on his face. And I've been told by people who knew him back then that he was not always Mr. Nice Guy, you know, but it's not, I don't see that in the letters at all. It's just, you know, but it may be that he didn't put it in letters. Maybe he knew he was going to go down in posterity and he didn't want it to be, you know, I don't know.
If he was in the period when he was shocking people or intentionally doing that, was he upset when people got upset? When they didn't get shocked? Because later on he was.
Do you want a really nice... I have a letter to read to you. It's really beautiful. And then, Kay, I swear to God, I'm going to just go straight to you.
Because after that, they did Europa, which was a big upset.
Oh, yeah.
He was quite upset after that.
But that was
for a while we recorded the conversation.
That was an upset. Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, he was attacked.
Well,
attacked. I don't mean
physical, but it was quite violent.
Yes, it was violent against him.
Verbally violent. And yeah. He was very upset.
In
Naropa.
Naropa.
He said, I have become so stupidly famous that people will come to hear me just because they're curious. They're not interested in my music at all. Why don't they just leave if they don't like it? Why do they stay and harass me like this? So it's a very different attitude from the early time.
Well, there's definitely things like that. I mean, there are definitely things like, there's a letter, for example, to an Anglican priest who writes to him that says, well, you don't see that letter, but the letter basically said, I really don't like your music at all, but I like your thoughts. So I'm wondering if you can write me a letter and explain your music. To which he says, you know, I can find that letter and read it to you. But he's basically saying, are you nuts? You know, you want to turn my music into words that I'll then speak to you so that you can listen to my music in a way that's not my music. You know what I mean? He really treats the guy like he's a little insane, and he suggests that since the guy likes Bruckner so much, that he listen to Bruckner 8 hours a day for days on end, and then after 27 days he'll find that it isn't interesting at all, but rather boring, or something like that, you know. So, but I don't actually see those as kind of that hostileness that I kind of got that Kyle was talking about, this real kind of anger toward the world about, but you do see stuff like that, where he says, ugh, you know, yeah, okay.
So on the same theme, I just talked to Percy Giannotti, and he said that Cage actually was very down on the Fluxus lyrics, that the composers around, you know, Giannotti and Cage, you know, people who were working together really projected, you know, but did not like Fluxus, did not want to have much to do with it. Have you heard anything like that, or is there anything in the literature?
There are a number of letters between Cage and Yoko Ono, where he flat out tells her he's not interested in her Bottoms project, he's not interested in Charlotte Mormon, he's not interested. But there were things he loved, you know, some of the work. He loved Toshi, but he acknowledges that Toshi was Toshi, that Toshi was not John Cage, that Toshi was very different. He acknowledges that.
Toshi told me that actually, one of the reasons he split up, that he and Yoko split up, is that she was much more honorable than he was.
No, I think that's true. I think that Cage was always pushing Toshi to be more experimental, be more whatever, and that Toshi once looked at him and said, "I'm not you." And there, that is actually quoted in one or two letters in here of Cage telling other people that and saying, "I remember Toshi saying that to me, that it was important for him." The letters don't reflect any sort of thematic push. Well, no, no, no. But it's a fair question. There's no overriding thing for or against something like Fluxus. The only thing that I can say that comes through, remember I said this is in decades, so the chronologies really look at what the letters are telling you about that decade. So, for example, the 70s are all about Thoreau. They're just all about Thoreau. All the works are about Thoreau, the letters he's writing, he writes to people involved in Thoreau, he's telling people about Thoreau's ideas. You know, that's really pervasive in there. You know, we can go decade by decade.
And Temp Bradshaw?
Dove is not really in here, so she's referenced. No. Dove lived in New York. She and Bill Anastasi went shopping for John Cage every other day.
She's a Fluxus artist.
Well, I don't know that I would call her a Fluxus artist,
She presented her in the letter. I remember reading it.
She has I think she's footnoted in here, but not as a recipient of a letter. She's just a person. I don't even think that he ever wrote to Bill Anastasi because they were just so close.
They stole each other.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say that my own experience of Cage, in a kind of general sense, and probably backed up by the letters, is that outside of his own obsessions, okay, so Satie was one of his obsessions. He stayed with Satie from the moment he discovered Satie in the 1940s to his death. He was obsessed with Satie. He was obsessed with Thoreau. He was obsessed with Misostic poems. You know, he was addicted to the process of Misostic writing. He loved them. But that his was always get out of whatever cage you're in. Like if I ever went to him, and I remember doing this once with a book by Susie Gablick. So I was reading, do you all know Susie Gablick? Do you remember Susie Gablick? She's still living, I don't know if she's writing anymore. She wrote this really beautiful book, I thought, called The Reenchantment of Art. The Reenchantment of Art. This would have been in the 80s. And I remember reading this book like a Bible. I was so turned by this book. I remember showing it to Cage, and he looked at it. He would always go to the back of books. Whatever I was reading, he would go to the back of the book and read like the last three pages. And then he would hand it back, either kind of a saying, okay, or, you know, kind of a thumbs down about it. But his attitude was always, be careful, don't stay out of cages, you know, that something may mean something to you this moment, but you'll grow and you'll change, and you don't need to, it doesn't have to be gospel. You don't have to ingest it. It can just be something that passes through you, kind of thing. I remember when Judith Malina came to visit once. Do you know who that is? Judith Malina and Julian Beck. Judith Malina was one of the founders of the Living Theater. She came to visit in the apartment, and I was working in the back room, and when I came out, Judith had left. I said hello to her, but then I went back to work. When I came out, there was this cactus flower in the garden. Big cactus flower, elaborate flower. And I looked at it and I said to John something like, what is that? You know, where did that come from? And he said, oh, Judith brought it. It's a surrealist flower. You know, and the way that he said it was like this, not derogatory, but this kind of poking fun at surrealists, you know, that they would only bring that kind of flower, you know. But he mocked himself as well. So, you know, I don't know. I don't think of him as being a particularly cool person or a particularly negative person, but people irritated him
As well they should. People can be very irritating.
Yeah.
What else? What else? The 60s are beautiful. Or the 50s are beautiful, actually. The 50s are, you know, it's his whole... Oh, I was going to read you this letter from to Helen Wolfe, Christian Wolfe's mother. I was going to read you this one letter. It's kind of a famous letter. Does anybody know this letter? This is a letter from John Cage to Christian Wolfe's mother. Christian Wolfe was Cage's, really is kind of his only real student. Other people have said they studied with John Cage, but Christian was really Cage's student. Christian went on to be one of four composers that, with John Cage, comprised the so-called New York School. So Earl Brown, Morton Feldman, John Cage, and Christian Wolfe. He was much younger than the others, and Christian has the distinction of not fully giving himself to composition, but rather became a classics teacher at Dartmouth and said he didn't want to put up with the penury of the life of a composer because he watched John Cage suffer his whole life. This is a letter. So Christian Wolfe brought home, this is before the New York City premiere of 4:33. So Christian Wolfe, who was Cage's student, this is dated 1954. So I don't know how old Christian, what year Christian was born. But he couldn't have been more than... So he would have been 20. So Christian was 20. Christian was helping out with the program matter for the New York concert that David Tudor and John Cage were going to give, and David and Christian brought home the program to show his mom. He was working on the program, and apparently Christian or David Tudor, you'll see from this letter, 4:33 is on the program. 4:33. Anybody not know what 4:33 is? Okay, good. So you're just torturing me. You have sisters, don't you? So Helen comes home, Christian comes home and shows her the program, and she's horrified to read the program note about 4:33. So she writes to Cage, and she says, it's implicit what she says by this letter, his reply. Dear Helen, I typewrite because the pen is so bad. The piece, meaning 4:33, the piece is not actually silent. There will never be silence until death comes, which never comes. It is full of sound, but sounds which I did not think of beforehand, which I hear for the first time the same time others hear. What we hear is determined by our own emptiness, our own receptivity. We receive to the extent we are empty to do so. If one is full, or in the course of its performance becomes full of an idea, for example, that this piece is a trick for shock and bewilderment, then that is, it is just that. However, nothing is single or unidimensional. This is an action among the 10,000. It moves in all directions and will be received in unpredictable ways. These will vary from shock and bewilderment to quietness of mind and enlightenment. If one imagines that I have intended any one of these responses, he will have to imagine that I have intended all of them. Something like faith must take over in order that we live affirmatively in the totality we do live in. With or without my intention, my art is cheapened and made expensive. That is not my concern. A death to myself takes place in composing, and in the event of the movement of this composition in the world, a second death to it as mine must take place. Otherwise, I shall be in fear and trembling, in a perilous situation of my own imagination. Isn't that beautiful? I know. It's incredible.
See, the letter from Helen Wolfe that occasioned that...
I'm sorry?
Helen Wolfe's letter has been published in Vienna, Texas, Germany, but Bridget wouldn't give me permission to publish it.
I don't know.
What a wonderful letter.
Yeah. You know my constant interest in Oriental thought, and you may think this has been misused to bring about a musical action which you cannot accept. As I see it, useful art has been illustrative or significant of belief, didactic. But what is that art which is not didactic nor symbolic, but to be experienced following having been taught? Clearly, life itself, of which we have only to become aware.
I am therefore not concerned with art as separate from such awareness, nor is the I Ching, hexagram 22, grace. Another friend of mine was disturbed about 4:33 and said with some heat that I apparently thought him stupid and incapable of hearing the sounds of everyday life, which he informed me he could, and with pleasure. I asked him why, if in private he could hear, he was disturbed to foresee doing so in public. To this he had to say, "You have a point." However, I do not wish to win an argument, nor will I. I also consulted the I Ching after receiving your letter and got exhaustion 47. Footnote. Cage consulted the I Ching, receiving hexagram 47 exhaustion, also known as oppression, because Helen Wolf did, writing to Cage that when she consulted the I Ching over her worry about this piece, she got hexagram 4, youthful folly, also known as inexperience. 4:33 is also a matter of consultation. Each person present will receive his own hexagram. I send this not to defend myself, but out of love for you and a sense of responsibility to you and to Mr. Wolf through my relation to Christian, from which I am not free. It is for that reason, being aware of your concern, that I repeat my practical offer to warn your friends of the experience in store for them. You have only to give me a list of names and addresses. P.S. Incidentally, it was not I but David who decided upon the program. I do not say this to shift the responsibility, but that you may be informed of how things actually take place. I composed the piece nearly 2 years ago. It was performed by David with mixed reactions at Woodstock, New York. The piece exists in the repertoire, and he chose to program it at the present time. I myself am detached. I am busy with other things, a new composition, concert details of management, this letter, and this springtime. Handwritten at the bottom of the page. I hope your illness disappears quickly. Reading this letter, I find it ministerial. That was my original intention in life, to become a Methodist minister. I moved so easily into a sermon. Not fun. So it's hard for me to, you know, sort of reconcile that with the angry John Cage who's, you know, spitting fire at people. But maybe he was that way with people that he didn't care about. You know what I mean? That he obviously cared about Helen, cared about Christian, he cared about Kurt Wolf, the father, as well. So.
Then letters to MC.
Yeah, many.
Yeah.
Many.
What happened? Is this stuff about what happened when she was they were all living in Stony Point, and then MC?
That's a good question. Are there any during that? He wouldn't have written to MC.
No, right. But I mean about that because she had, I think she felt sort of somehow excluded.
I've heard that. Yeah, and I've seen that in her letters at the Getty. But there's nothing in here. He wouldn't have written, nor in retrospect would he have. I think that was her private struggle. Uh-huh. I think it was MC's private struggle.
But the relationship with Cage and between Cage and MC afterwards.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Always
that's
fantastic. Yeah.
She was always very positive about
yeah.
him.
No, she loved him and he loved her.
Yeah.
I've heard that about that she felt sort of second citizen.
Yeah.
Well, that she was the person who did the dishes. She, you know, so she was marginalized as a female. I'm not sure that she ever expressed that
no,
to the men.
She never talked like that. She just...
Yeah.
But you heard that from some... Yeah.
Did you ever go through her letters at the Getty? Have you ever looked at them? You really should do that. It is incredible to me. It was a revelation when I read them because her... That's why I said what I said about David Tudor and John Cage and Tudor's marrying MC because those letters very clearly... David is not. I don't even know how to say this without. It's all public now, though. I mean, it's not like I'm making this stuff up, but that she's complaining that he's withdrawn himself sexually from her to reserve his energy for performing and to you know, except that she's appealing to anyone who will listen because she was such a sexual being. MC was. She was just
like a flower, you know, so looking for little birds and bees around her, you know. And he, it's just, it was her karma or her fate or whatever, that she would connect with somebody like David Tudor, who was kind of ascetic anyway. Yeah, that he wasn't a particularly physical person. He was very of the mind. He was a very interesting guy that way. Anyway.
Laura,
yeah.
You know that Jenny was surfing because of the
sure.
And on the unseen's presenting.
Yeah, and marginalization.
Being left out of various
things. Yeah, yeah.
But the boys were doing this.
Yeah.
It's just surfing.
Yeah. It's hard for me to reconcile having not known MC, because I didn't know her, but I met her many times. I mean, when I was teaching in Arizona, I brought her out there. We did a workshop together for a week. I drove her around all over Arizona looking for the just pair of cowboy boots. She had a real crush on my boss and talked to me endlessly about him. And she was I just couldn't imagine her feeling oppressed and not expressing it. You know what I mean? She was so...
Well, Sorkin says she did express it.
To whom? I mean, why is this not recorded anywhere?
You know, at that symposium we did at Bard.
Yeah, that the Cage Trust did. Yes, of course. Yeah. She worked on the paper with me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know how that's documented. I heard her read it, but I haven't read it.
Hmm.
But I think people are complicated.
Of course, of course.
Differently at different times.
Of course.
And are ambivalent.
Yeah. There's no evidence that MC ever expressed such a thought to Cage, or Cage ever was aware of MC feeling that way.
If you say MC, it's confusing because you're not talking about Marsh
MC. No. Mary Caroline Richards.
No, it's not fair. You have to see what
she's Her name is MC. She goes by MC, MC Richards.
That's too poetic. That's too much.
She was a poet and a potter.
Nurse didn't have an MC.
Right, ever. No. Ever.
So there's lots more wine, too.
Yeah, I'm going to have some more.